Good evening, and welcome to January 2022's Dante's Old South. I'm your host, Clifford Brooks, and in this episode, we have a poet, a painter, and a businessman all here ready to share their stories, inspirations, and hopes. Before we begin, let me give a special thank you to WUTC and NPR for allowing me this time to goof around and have fun. And without wasting another second, let's jump into our first interview with Sky Jackson. And up first on Dante's, we have poet and New Orleans native Sky Jackson. Sky, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Cliff. I'm happy to be here with you, as per always.
Now, this is not the first time we've worked together, and that makes this a lot easier. And what I want the people to know first is that your poetry is unmatched. I can't compare it to anyone in the fact of its tone and the uniqueness of its voice. To kick off the show on a high note, tell us how you developed your voice as a poet to achieve what you've got now.
Oh, thank you. That's really kind. I appreciate that. I'm always trying to tweak my process, and I always love to hear feedback on my work so I can, you know, exercise some level of quality control there.
Right. That's a great way to look at it. So many people, as far as the, you know, concerning the how do you develop your voice in poetry, I have always kind of held to the idea that you write the way you speak. And as you tweak that a little bit to be poetic, you'll that's the fastest way to find your voice. Do you find that to be true?
I think it depends. You know, I think every poem calls for a different voice.
Right.
You know, and so I guess it's more about trying to figure out how to access each voice that you want to utilize to convey the poem. You know, like, do I want to come from a place of sadness? Do I want to come from a place of joy? Do I want to come from a place of anger? And figuring out how to do that in an effective way that doesn't like push people away, but draws yes. them in closer, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think it's more of like trying to figure out how to use each voice that already kind of lives inside of us all the time, you know, like how do you use that? How do you translate so that other people can understand it?
Now, to grab the tail of this comment, I want to keep this going forward in the same direction. Let's back away from voice. When you sit down from soup to nuts with a poem, how does it come to mind? How do you lay it down, and how do you edit it to its completion?
You know, my process regarding that has been changing. Normally I would, and I think it had a lot to do with the pandemic. So I would be the kind of poet who would kind of like be riding on the train or like waiting at a coffee shop or something. And when the pandemic happened, it was like there was less opportunities for that. Mm-hmm. And so now what I've been doing recently is I'll come up with like a list. I'm like, okay, these are things I want to write poems about.
Yeah.
You know, and then when I sit down to write, I can look at my list and say like, oh yeah, like I want to write about this and I want to write about that. So then I'll just start like going through my list and writing about it. Like I might not be able to write a poem in that moment, but I'm like, okay, I know later I need to write a poem about X, Y, and Z. Yeah. So that's kind of how I've been approaching my process lately. And I've found that it's been pretty helpful because I'm not sitting there like, okay, what happens next? I'm like, okay, I've got a direction. You know, like sometimes that's all you need is some sort of direction to get you into that headspace, I guess.
Yeah. Now you mentioned the listing and you mentioned being organized and now I feel very lazy in the way I create, like that's a great idea. And so again, let's expand a little bit on that. On the broader scheme with life and family, the pandemic, other work, how do you fit writing poetry and refining that process into that hectic schedule you have?
That's something that I have really struggled with, you know? But like I said, even if I don't have time to write in that moment, I can write down like, okay, on my list, like I want to write a poem about this or that, or this or that, you know, sometimes it's like easy to forget. And you're like, wait, I said I was going to write a poem about something. What was it? So now I just make my little list or whatever, you know, sometimes I feel like it's hard to make myself sit in front of the computer and like type things up, you know, because it's like we spend so much of our time already like on the computer every day.
Yeah.
Oh, so the last thing I want to do on a weekend is sit in front of a computer and I still feel like I'm working, you know?
Yes, I do.
And I think I've like, that's something, and I don't, if you have any advice on that, I would love to hear it, but I struggle with that so much. Like, I want to be out and about. I want to be taking walks. I want to be like hanging out. I want to be in front of my computer. And I think that has been like a big barrier for me like lately, you know, but a few nights ago, I was able to go to like a writer's workshop and like we all sat down and I had my list and like I didn't know what the format was going to be. I was like, are we bringing something to share? What are we doing? And they were like, no, we just sit here and write. And so I was like, oh, okay, well, I have my list, so I'm just gonna like start writing. And that's what I did, you know. And so I think it's trying to find those moments, like if it is a writer's group or someone to hold you accountable or something that you can just like do it. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense. And the exuberance in your poetry, the commonplace that you make your own, it's a symphony to watch you and read what you create. There's a definite, and I'm not trying to inject a soul there, but there's definitely this spirituality that I hope and feel is universal. When you sit down to write your poetry, do you feel that you channel something bigger than yourself? Is it a spiritual process for you?
I think so. Like sometimes like something I'll just kind of like click out and then it's just like, I'm in the poem, you know? And that's like when I know something is happening, when I'm just like scribbling and scribbling and scribbling and I'm like, wow, I'm really accessing something. And that doesn't always happen, right? Like sometimes you sit down and you're trying to write a poem and you're like, why isn't it happening right now? You know, it's like, ah. and that's when it gets hard. But lately I found that like I've been able to kind of like get back into that wavelength. So I feel really lucky and really blessed about that, you know, like because it was hard for a while. Like I went through a lot last year and it was just kind of like I couldn't, like I would sit down and I couldn't write anything. I was just like, what is happening? Like am I just an empty glass, you know?
Yeah, it is. And I'm oh man, see, this is what I've always wondered too. With the idea of writer's block, I've often wondered like, is it really some kind of an impediment in the mind that people can't get around, or like you're imagining? I think what's happening to me, if I understand what you're saying, is that sometimes you feel so emptied out, there's nothing left to write about and you have to live a little to fill that cup up again. Is that kind of close to what you're talking about?
Yes, I agree. I think writer's block is like a very harsh term and I don't actually think that's how it works. I think it's more so like we're always absorbing, right?
Right.
We're like sponges, and sometimes it's like we're at the end of our like absorption, or like the beginning. We're at the beginning of our absorption, right? And so there's nothing like left to like squeeze. There's nothing to squeeze out yet because you're still kind of like, you're still kind of taking things into you. And then once you get to the point where you have fully absorbed something, then you can sit down and you have something for the page. But that's kind of how I think about it, you know?
Yeah.
Like I need to like be talking to people. I need to be going to readings. I need to be trying to get inspired by what other people are doing so that I can sit down and do what I do, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. And I want more people to be inspired by what you do. So as we wind this down, tell us how we can find you on social media and tell us about your book.
Okay, so on social media, I am on Instagram, super active there. My handle is @skyinthecity. I'm also on Facebook. You can just find me by putting in Sky Jackson. Mm-hmm. There's also my website, which woefully needs to be updated. it's www.skyjackson.com. In terms of my book, some exciting news. It's going through a reprinting right now, and I'm going to add some audio components to it. So that should be really cool. And I'm really excited about that. So you can find that on antennapress.com or through my website. There's a link that reprinting be coming out in a few weeks, I'm thinking. So yeah, check it out.
I'm going to get the part of that. I cannot wait. I cannot wait. You're also a brand new editor with the Blue Mountain Review, and you have an interview coming out in the next issue of the Blue Mountain Review later this month. Definitely go out there and look for it on February 1st, and you'll find more about Miss Skye Jackson, her books, and how to follow her links to see why she's done so much for so many and moved me to write better poetry. So, Miss Skye, before I let you go, I understand that you've got some fresh poems and you want to share one of those with us?
Yes. So I'll just give you guys a little preface to this poem. I'm from New Orleans, as Cliff mentioned, and there is a guy there. His name is Sam Caruso, and he makes like this amazing ice cream. And so this poem is about Sam. He his business is called Lousy Ice Cream. So you guys in New Orleans, if you're listening, please check it out. It's very good. But this is my poem. I wrote it a few nights ago, and it is called Ice Cream Sam.
Okay.
Ice Cream Sam picks me up down on Burgundy. It's the Wednesday before Christmas when I climb into his truck. His Seventh Ward accent dripping in my ear like molasses, sweet and slow. He tells me about his cats, the sweet one and the crazy one, the ice cream he pours his soul into. He names one Butter Off Dead, and I love him already. As we arrive to the restaurant, Cafe des Gars all lit up and yet still dim. I'm the only Black person in the restaurant, of course, except for our waiter, who seems distant and does not keep my glass filled with wine. Ice Cream Sam is a foodie, so for us, he orders mussels, sweetbreads, French onion soup. He sips sparkling water, gave up the booze, the drugs years ago, you know? But later, when we stand in line to ride the coaster at City Park, I realize he still loves the rush, gets giddy at the thought of it. His big calloused hands inside my coat. Tonight, on that coaster, we'll swirl together round and round until we are cold and sweet, just like his ice cream. And that is the poem.
Skye, now I'm hungry and moved. You don't understand what I would do for ice cream. What would I do for a Klondike bar is probably felonies in most states. And I'm serious, guy. I can't thank you enough for coming on this show. I cannot. And in the next couple of months, as things rev up in your career or continue to, please let me know. We'll bring you back on this show.
That sounds great. I would love that.
Awesome. Well, Skye, thank you so much. And before we bring on our next guest, let's take this energy to full tilt with Shine On, You Crazy Diamond by Pink Floyd. Thank you. And up next on Dante, we're sitting with Inam, a man known around the world for his heavy textured landscape paintings. Inam, it is amazing to have you here, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, and it's my pleasure to be on your program, Clifford.
What a jump into this with both feet, man. Tell us some of the high points of your life that got you where you are today.
Oh, boy. I'm based in Atlanta, 60 years old now, but I was born and raised in Pakistan, mm-hmm. and I'm a polio patient. And when I was a little boy, I was not able to go out and play with other boys soccer or cricket or whatever. So my art teacher took me aside and she used to give me art lessons every day. And that's how it all started. And that became part of me, my personality. And I basically evolved from there on. I got into the professional art about 25 years ago, mm-hmm. and adopted landscape as my style. Although I've done everything, you know, from portraits to abstracts to everything.
When you look back over your career as a painter, what did you sacrifice to create your art? What did you have to not do in order to dedicate? Because we met at the Vinings Gallery down in Roswell, Georgia, not long ago. And mm-hmm. what of course people can't see on the radio is that to say textured. I mean, it's literally your work is a painted 3D portrait. And the whole time I was looking at your art, the kid in me had to keep saying, don't touch it, don't touch it, don't touch it, because you want to so bad. And I can't imagine, and I'm not trying to, I mean, it is incredible to stand in front of. And the reason I say all of that is because I want to give the audience some kind of idea when I ask you, like, to, in order to sit down and not just paint the portrait, of which I'm not making light of that at all, but mm-hmm. to do what you do, what did you have to give up in order to make that happen?
Well, from the I don't know if I really sacrificed anything, but... Well, that's a good question. I never thought about that, but I really don't think I sacrificed anything, Clifford. Actually, it's on the other spectrum that I actually gained a lot from it. And, you know, art gave me the opportunity to recreate my own reality.
Who
said that the object of art is not to reproduce reality, but to create a reality of the same intensity? So, you know, it's that kind of stuff. Having that opportunity is amazing. So I really don't think that I had to sacrifice anything to do what I do, because I just love what I do.
You don't hear that a lot. And I'm glad I got that on tape. And I'm not kidding you, man. It's, and I'm not looking on I don't think you're taking it this way. I mean, I'm not looking on art with some sort of dour tone, but it's just, because when I'm around you, like you exude the same energy and the same positivity that you're putting on the show now. And mm-hmm. that's when I'm like, I gotta get this person on NPR like now. But it's when you look at the art, the spiritual journey that you've been on, you've traveled all over Europe to catch some of these paintings, right?
I did. I did.
Tell us about, and I've heard some of the stories, but tell us some of your favorite spots you stopped to make some of your paintings work.
Sure. Just to give you my background, I never attended a fine art school to get a degree in art or anything.
Okay? Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. I'm self-taught. And and as I mentioned, how I had started when I was 5 years old, you know, mm-hmm. and so I had lots of teachers who gave me time on one-on-one, basically, to bring me where I am today. Uh-huh. But in my pursuit of finding new things, new ideas, how to think, how to imagine, how to act, I had to learn from different masters. Mm-hmm. And for that sake, basically, I traveled a lot, primarily in Europe. Mm-hmm. The most visited place or place where I attended most of my traveling courses or short courses was Italy, mm-hmm. England, Spain, France, Turkey, even Japan. So these were the countries that I visited the most to basically grasp the depth of other people's work, uh-huh. and to learn and spend time with them as their intern or traveling partners, and spending 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks together. And that has been my university has been these people. You know, these are the people who taught me what I have learned.
That's extraordinarily fascinating to me, because I know nothing about it. How do you set up that kind of internship?
Well, it's basically an artist's connection, you know, that you sometimes you go through third parties who basically connect you. And then when you become yourself known to the community out there, uh-huh. which happened to me about, I'm going to say about 10, 12, 13 years ago, that I started becoming more and more known to the community outside, especially in other countries.
Right.
Clifford, I'm going to stop here for a second.
Okay. I agree with you. No, that's what's awesome. You're absolutely perfect. No, because Richard, we got plenty of time. And the producer of this show is just going to hear this and clip it out and we'll pick up.
Yeah.
So no, yeah. I was really hoping, I didn't want to stop you, but I was like, you should stop. Let's just pause it.
Yeah. I think he's gonna. Great timing for him, you know. So...
And next on NPR, The Lawn Man. Yeah, dude, this is cool.
Let me go and tell him. Give me 2 minutes.
Okay.
I'll be right back.
No problem. So what fascinates me about what you just told me is it's something that I know nothing about. And that's how you find a mentor like that in which you travel with. How do you hook that up? How do you find that connection?
Well, when you become a professional artist, you get connected to other artists through different sources. Either it's person-to-person contact through art exhibits and shows.
Okay.
Sometimes these curators basically introduce you, connect you. And then if you express your interest, there are online sources available and have been available for the last many years, actually, through third parties who basically connect you to other people.
Right.
And so I found basically what was out there through travel sources, actually. Mm-hmm. And there are advertised programs, and you have to be very selective in terms of who do you associate yourself with? Are they the true artist community or not? And I was lucky to always find the right people, right group to travel with.
Do you find that when you do something you love for the right reasons, with the right people, with the right passion, that your life finds those right places at the right time?
Absolutely. You become a family instantly.
Yeah.
And there is a very unique kind of connectivity in that kind of community, you know?
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to describe, but people who are above average in terms of understanding where you are coming from.
Right.
And what you like to do, what your aspirations are, and where you want to go. And there are times when it's competition also.
Right.
But it's the people that you understand better and they understand you better.
Gotcha. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I want some of that, man. It's because you have a lot. I mean, I've never really thought about it. And I'm not trying to go off on a tangent here, though I'm about to. You when you said earlier, make sure that you work with the right people. It's not a status issue. It's a dedication issue.
Absolutely.
And if people forget that, it's not a judgment. It's like, how bad do you want this? It's good to hear somebody. The positivity that comes off of you, if I could bottle that, I'd never have to work again. I'm serious. It's a positivity that I wish it was more of in the world. And you take that positivity a step further into action because you're involved and you're passionate. You mentioned earlier of having polio when you were a child. What foundations are you in now that you're passionate about?
Yes, that's very true. I mean, I'm very proud of that and actually humbled to be affiliated with some renowned organizations such as UNICEF, such as Rotary Club. For the eradication of polio. There are only two countries left now in the world, and we are working hard to get rid of polio from those countries too. So I, through UNICEF and Rotary, I auction off my art for fundraising purposes. I also speak on their behalf, go out, and whenever there is a need, especially in the southeast of the U.S., to go out and speak on their behalf to raise funds, awareness of what is needed to be done. I also co-founded a local charity called the Glitter of Hope Foundation.
Right on.
Which is, I'm going to say 11 or 12 years ago, and which is dedicated for taking care of the single moms who come as refugees into this country and don't have any educational background, and we try to bring them on their feet.
Uh-huh.
and bring their children up to the speed for the school system. You know, my time is well spent when I go out and speak on behalf of UNICEF or Rotary Club, or even for the Glitter Hope Foundation. And my art really helps me a whole lot to get in and be able to send a message across.
We need more of that, man. And with Christmas just behind us, you know, and the new year in front of us, it's good to hear this, because I mean, more people took up not just their action in charity, but to look at it and find something they love to do. It sounds to me, if I'm hearing you correctly, like, you know, one really feeds the other, and it's energy and positivity. Is that true?
Absolutely. That's very true.
Awesome.
Very true.
Now, we have two parts here. I want people, first, tell us how we find the foundations of which you support, so we may find out more and support it as well.
Well, UNICEF is you know, you just, UNICEF and Rotary Club polio eradication programs, if you just do Google those, you will get lots of resources.
Okay.
UNICEF has an office in Atlanta, and they operate out of Atlanta for their Southeast region. Mm-hmm. A lot of well-known people, a lot of famous people are involved with that. And so it's easy to find and locate them. The other charity that I mentioned, which is a local charity focused for the refugee community, especially single moms coming to the Atlanta area. The name of the organization is the Glitter of Hope Foundation, and the website is glitterofhope.org.
Okay.
So if you can go on the line online and explore them out. Easy access these days.
Oh yeah, the web makes everything right there. And that's the next step, is how do we find you online and let folks see the art that you create?
Absolutely. Ideal way to reach me would be my website also, which is inamgallery.com, inamgallery.com. Mm-hmm. It does have my personal contact information. It does have my representation information. It does have some examples of my work. And we'll be glad to communicate with anyone who has any interest.
Outstanding. Well, Inam, it has been amazing to have you on the show. And as time goes on, you have new stuff come out, we got to have you back on to talk about that.
Thank you very much. I'll be more than happy to come anytime, Clifford.
All right, brother. Thank you so much. And now, before we bring on the next guest, let's hear Easy by Lionel Richie.
Know it sounds funny, but I just can't stand the pain. Girl, I'm leaving you tomorrow. Seems to me, girl, you know I've done all I can. See a big store and I'm borrowed. Yeah. So I'm easy. I'm easy like Sunday morning. Yeah. That's why I'm easy. So easy. I'm easy like Sunday morning. Sing it for me.
Anybody wanna put chains on me? Paid my dues to make it. Everybody wants me to be what they want me to be. But I'm not happy when I try to fake it. That's why I'm easy. I'm easy like Sunday morning.
That's why I'm easy. So easy.
That's why I'm easy like Sunday morning. I wanna be high.
play it right here for me.
Easy like Sunday morning.
Whoa. That's why I'm easy. So easy. Yes, I'm easy like Sunday morning.
That's why I'm easy.
Whoa.
I'm easy like
easy
Sunday
like
morning.
And up now on Dante's, we have Nicholas Lamb, Director of Business Development with the Red Phone Booth. Nicholas, how are you doing?
Good, Clifford, man. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure to have you on, boss. Let's jump in with both feet and begin at the beginning. How did you get your start in the beverage and hospitality industry?
Yeah, so pretty much growing up my entire life, my mom was in the restaurant industry. She was a part owner of a place called Bay and Surf. It was in Laurel, Maryland, actually, where I grew up. She started as a server, became a GM, then became an operating partner. And I pretty much spent my babysitting time there with her. So, you know, they call people bar babies. I was one of those bar babies. So
I have never heard that before.
Yeah, it's a major term in the world of that I live in. So
right,
majority
on.
Of us that are lifers in this industry started somehow when they were very young. So, yeah, we.
Yeah. But, now, you know, moving forward, is you know, we're going to touch on the Red Phone Booth where you are now, but mm-hmm. to before you took the helm there, you had to have your feet wet in whiskey at some point. What drew you to that? Where did that fascination come from?
Yeah, so I mean, like, even before that, like, dealing with my mom's restaurant too, going back to a little bit the early path, you know, she it was a fine dining seafood restaurant. So I kind of dove in with, you know, great food background. I got to work in the kitchen when I was a child, learned a lot from a lot of really, really cool chefs, and really kind of had a cool upbringing in just hospitality. I remember shadowing servers when I was younger as well. And, you know, watching as they just kind of made it look easy. There was one server that I remember forever. And he kind of coined a term, it's like butter. And, you know, he kind of floated on the floor, and it was kind of art for me. Mm-hmm. So kind of really attracted me to the industry. And, you know, I kind of just dove head first. I started kind of my career in bartending, of course. And, you know, I did bar backing, busing, to-goes, expo, you know, serving, bartending, so on and so forth, but kind of got my, you know, really, really whiskey knowledge from bartending. Of course, you know, I kind of dove in and really, really, you know, got solid with it. I found bourbon and, you know, had a bunch of regulars who just love bourbon, kind of got into that. And bourbon is such a great thing, but it's kind of finite, right? And actually, right. After I mastered bourbon, I kind of started dabbling into scotch, which I never thought I was going to love. But now I don't drink anything but scotch nowadays. And then, so, you know, as my career progressed, I kind of went out to Austin, Texas, lived out there for a little while, learned bar programs, learned craft cocktails, but kept with the whiskey. You know, whiskey was always my passion. So moved back to Georgia, actually moved to Georgia, and found a place called the Whiskey Project. It's a little whiskey bar that housed about 1,400 total spirits, majority of that whiskey. And I pretty much, it was like a kid in a candy store. I had access to all of it. Joined up with those guys, became the operating partner there for almost 3 years, and just sponged everything. You know, from bourbons to rye to American whiskeys to scotch to, you know, Irish to Taiwanese to, you know, you name it. I've tried everything. And I don't think I've found anything that I just dislike, you know.
Well, how did your passion and intellect lead you to the Red Phone Booth?
Actually by happenstance, really. After COVID, kind of not after COVID, but after the shutdown, of course, my partner and I just weren't seeing eye to eye, and, you know, we just separated. I had a buddy of mine, his name's Adam Kepler. He works for a company called Edrington. Edrington owns a couple small companies called McAllen and, you know, a couple other major ones like Highland Park, you know, very small companies. he's like, "Hey man, give me your resume." And I was like, "Man, I just don't know." He's like, no, it's worth it. So I'm thinking he's getting me a job with like a distributor or maybe in his line of work, which would have been super cool, you know, dealing with just whiskey all the time. Right. He's like, no, I got something for you. So I sent it to him. I only send my resume to one person. That's him. So I'm laying in bed one night. It's about 10 o'clock at night. And I get an email from a gentleman by the name of Stephen Nahan. And it pretty much like, you know, said, "Hey, your resume came across my desk. You know, I really, really like what I read. And, you know, I've already gotten, you know, an earful from Adam about you. I'd really love to sit down and talk to you." Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was sitting there looking at my fiance at the time and I was like, "Man, I don't even know who this person is." So I go ahead and Google him, of course. And, you know, he just the rich background that he comes from, and you will learn all about that with him. But, you know, he started Red Phone Booth, and, you know, it was kind of an idea from his grandfather, right? You know, the speakeasy 1920s craft cocktails, but happened to have cigars and all the good stuff. And so I met with him, had a nice little interview, actually had a Zoom interview. It was slotted for about 15 minutes. It went about almost 2 hours. so we had a lot to talk about. And then met up with his partner in downtown. His name's Greg Grant, and really kind of dove in with him. And then, you know, the rest is history. Been with them ever since. So
nice, man. Now tell us specifically about your role with the Red Phone Booth. What do you do there?
Right now I'm the director of business development and operations. What I do is I pretty much am going to help grow this brand. Right now we sit at three stores of Red Phone Booth, two Amalfi Kitchens and one Saito Sushi under our umbrella group, which is called Roaring Hospitality. Mm-hmm. And we are planning on getting a little bit bigger, in the sense of, you know, we've already started selling a little franchises. So we have two franchises already booked out, for one in Brickell, which is in like north of Miami, mm-hmm. and then one in like West Palm Beach area. Mm-hmm. And then corporate side, which is where I primarily work for, we've got one going to Dallas, Texas. And Dallas is going to be kind of like a little bit north of Dallas. It's in what's known as the Colony, and we're in a subsection called the Grandscape, which is it's gorgeous, work, play, live. And they kind of came to us about it. They were like, "Hey, you know, we really love what Red Phone Booth does. You know, we love that, you know, the atmosphere and the environment and what you guys bring to the hospitality game. You know, we want to see this in Grandscape." So here we go. I mean, this is going to be our first after, you know, we went to Nashville. So that's a little out of our comfort zone from Georgia. Right. And then Nashville is wildly successful. And just because Nashville is such a great place to be. And we're just going to see what happens in Dallas. We're super excited. So I'm going to be out there making sure that, you know, the wheels are turning and making sure that we're just doing the correct things the right way, living by the credo that we live by. And, you know, we really, really want to push forward with how good Red Phone Booth is and show the rest of the world what it's about.
Well, I mean, I can stop right here and tell the folks I've seen you work, man. And it's like watching a conductor put up a symphony. I don't know how you deal with that chaos. I watched it from afar and thought a dozen times, like, I'd stamp somebody. I was straight stamp. And you never broke a smile. It was always so easy. So, I mean, swinging back, it's, you know, you're talking about the growth. You're talking about, you know, the franchises and the expansion. How has the Red Phone Booth adjusted since the pandemic to make all this happen?
Yeah, I mean, gosh. You know, the pandemic has been good to some companies in the sense of like that it's made people money, which is crazy to me. You know, we're all going through this crazy time that none of us know how to really, you know, traverse. We're all just kind of faking it till we make it, if you will, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, what's cool about what we do as a company, and I think what Steven did, and a lot of people, we kind of talk to people about this, but I don't think people quite understand the lengths that we've gone to, you know, we saw the problem. Mm-hmm. We saw what was going on. And Steven's like, "Hey man, I need to figure out how to make people feel safe in our environment." Right. You know, we are a speakeasy. We don't have a windows. We don't have places for, you know, major ventilation. So how do we get ventilation in? Well, so Stephen did a bunch of research. He first started off with what's called a direct outdoor air system, which is kind of exactly what Vegas has or the Dubai airport. We are literally pumping in 100% oxygen at all times. We're recycling our air every 3 minutes in our units, all of our units, right? Mm-hmm. And on top of that, we go to the next level. So we're scrubbing the air on top of that, right? You know, constantly scrubbing, recycling, and then purging. And then the third thing we're doing is what's called needlepoint bipolar ionization. Now, it's a big, big word. And pretty much how that works, though, you know, Stephen went out and he's like, okay, well, how do hospitals, you know, how are hospitals handling what's going on? How do they, you know, they all have air conditioners. They all have air supplies. Like, you know, I know the majority of people are wearing masks in hospitals, but not all the time, right? Like, you know, the physicians and stuff like that are doing that, but, you know, the general public's not.
Right.
How are people safe there? So they have that system. It's called needlepoint bipolar ionization. The Mayo Clinic has it. You know, John Hopkins uses it. You know, these are major, massive hospitals that, you know, care about the well-being of people. So, you know, what do we have to do the same thing? So he, you know, I'm not even going to tell you a dollar figure because it doesn't matter.
Right.
But it, you know, he installed these in every one of our locations, Nashville, Atlanta, and Buckhead. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, essentially what's happening is we're raining ions. It is destroying, you know, airborne illness, you know, COVID, flu, you name it. It is constantly cleansing and scraping everything. So pretty much what's happening is you're almost safer inside than you are outside sometimes
right.
with us. So it's pretty cool. And you know, when it comes to just business, of course, you know, just making people feel comfortable, you know, that's half the game. So Red Foam was already kind of designed for that motto. You know, we have our nooks and crannies, our large couches, our kind of like areas for people to really feel safe. So, you know, we already kind of had the leg up there where I know a lot of restaurants had to struggle with, you know, the 6 feet apart and so on and so forth. You know, we already had that pre-designed as it was. So.
Sweet, man. Now, a lot of restaurants and a lot of the hospitality industry has been hit by, you know, issues and problems with hiring staff. Y'all have an amazing staff. I mean, how did y'all make that happen?
Yeah, man. I mean, it's all about just development of the staff. You know, we live in the industry now that being in the restaurant industry is not seen as like the glory days anymore. I think, you know, back in the day, people, you know, loved working in the restaurant industries. There was passion about it. And sadly, some of that passion has been kind of expunged, you know, by either transient people that, you know, just come into the industry to make a quick buck, they don't care, and they get out. You know, and it doesn't, you know, and also with how stressful this environment is, it's not for everybody. You know, there's times where, you know, guests that come into different locations or not even Red Phone Booths, just in general, just aren't the nicest individuals, you know, and you have to deal with that on a daily basis. You have to, you know, spin around. Someone made a snide comment. You just have to spin around and all of a sudden put a smile back on your face. And that's not for everybody, you know? So we won the approach of, first off, you know, our guests are unbelievably important to us, but so as same as our staff is, you know, we will listen. We take time to really, really, you know, cultivate our staff. And that comes down to training. I mean, ongoing training all the time. You know, we do a biweekly training with our guys and our girls, and we are constantly trying to give them the information and things they need to be successful and wildly successful at what they do.
Right on.
So, you know, it's crazy right now trying to staff. You know, that's not a joke. That is a big problem in the restaurant industry right now. And, you know, we're all dealing with it. It's just, you know, treat your staff right. They'll treat you right. You know,
that's true, man. Now, there are memberships that you can buy into the Red Phone Booth. Tell us about the experience of the Red Phone Booth and why memberships are important, or how that behooves.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So I won't even talk about prices right now, because we'll just talk about kind of the basics of what our membership does, right? Mm-hmm. So we have three types of tiers of membership. And you know, the first tier, and I don't even say tiers, it's just, you know, the privileges and stuff like that. We have our associate membership. That gets you access to every one of our locations. Okay. So that gives you access to Atlanta. That gives you access to Buckhead. That gives you access to Nashville, soon to be Dallas, Texas, soon to be Brickell, Florida, soon to be so on and so forth. Yeah. You know, you get the idea. Mm-hmm. And so when you're vacationing, we're trying to find places where Red Phone Booths fit in vacation maps, like where people really like to visit. So like, you know, you live in Atlanta. I mean, I love going to Nashville. Well, you know what? You can make a reservation while you're in Nashville, hit up the Red Phone Booth in Nashville and have a great time, because you already know how consistent we are in mm-hmm. Atlanta, we're going to bring that consistency over to Nashville as well. So, you know exactly what you're walking into. Now, different environment, different layout, different build a little bit, different staff, different, you know, same cocktail, same program, but, you know, everything's a little bit different, of course, and all things. We're not trying to get stale or anything like that. So that's the first one. Second tier, we have what's known as locker membership. Now we have personal lockers. Now, most people know this, but some people that don't know things about Red Phone Booth, we are a speakeasy, but we happen to also sell cigars. We sell about 100 different facings of cigars. And that's where that direct outdoor air system really comes into play, right? Yeah. So you're able to buy cigars in-house or bring your own cigars in and store them in our humidified lockers. Yeah. So you get to, you know, maybe you have some great cigars at home. You just don't have the proper humidifier. You don't have the proper, whatever it may be to kind of store them. We'll do the storage for you. We monitor them. We make sure everything, your cigars are perfect. We are auditing those lockers all the time. The only thing you're allowed to put in our lockers is cigars. Yeah. And then we have the third tier, which is corporate, which is self-explanatory. You know, it's for corporations that want to bring in a lot more people, a bigger locker. You get to put like a nice corporate nameplate on there, and you just get to visit on that. Wherever location you have for that locker is where your locker lives, but you're still eligible to go to every one of our locations.
Right on, man. Right on. It is. It, I mean, again, it's infectious, the positivity and the optimism. Like, I want one. I want a locker. I want that. Because, I mean, I've been to all three locations now. And you're absolutely mm-hmm. right, is that there's a branding there, but each one has its own feel to that area. Yep. You know, it's always far from stale. Nicholas Lamb, it was amazing to have you on. And I know that we're going to have you all back as things develop, because it's such an exciting scene to be a part of, man. And I can't thank you enough for letting me be there.
Thanks, man. I appreciate you guys coming in.
All right, man. Yes, let's listen to Sunday Morning by the Main Street. You're always shining with your Sunday morning smile. I said you're always shining with your Sunday morning smile. I love the way you smile.
Flip your pancake, baby, I can brew your coffee too. I don't even drink it, but I'll make it hot for you. Ask me why I love you, I got answers I can give a few. But I can't stop staring at me. Ooh, I give all my love and all my heart to you. There's something special.
Y'all, thank you so much for sitting with me for this episode of Dante's Old South. Happy New Year.
My name is Clifford Brooks, and I look forward to many more hours coming this year. We can sit down and share stories and to make the world a little easier on all of us. And I hope I've given you a little bit of that this evening. Before I walk out of here, let me thank WUTC and NPR again for allowing me this time, and Woodbridge Inn in Jasper, Georgia, for giving me the peace of mind and solace to sit down and record these interviews. As I step away, let me read you a poem from my new book coming out soon called The Book of Old Gods. And this poem is Wanting Romulus. Wanting Romulus grows into an olive tree. Fruit refuses to ripen. The ruler's homespun clothes are cut from the wolf who nursed him. Hewn to each other always, two brothers chew bitter roots. In the 1980s, Remus shared his ice cream cone. Young mouths unburdened by fear of looking foolish, not certain their heads would bend down as the frown the dead wear when we speak. Romulus confesses his quest for fame, and it became stains on his hands that slapped his brother's pale face. Murder made the news. Pillars stabbed into red earth. A king's kids, the result of hard work and its consequence. Homeless, old hats left on a hook to regain the sky.